Have you ever had a moment where you think, man, someone should really do something about this? Then you realize maybe that someone is you. Well, with the help of GoFundMe, you can change someone's life. You could start a GoFundMe to help a friend pay for school, fund that new community space, or help a local kid finally get to that national competition. I've seen this myself. Last year, a friend of mine launched a GoFundMe to help with medical bills after an unexpected surgery. It was incredible how fast the support rolled in. People want to help. They just need a way to do it. And GoFundMe makes it easy. So do you have a dream, a person, or a cause in your life that could use some support? Don't wait for someone else to bring change. You can be the one who makes a difference. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform, trusted by over 200 million people. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com.
Happy first Tuesday of the month, cultists. How do the Reavers clean their harpoons? They simply put them in the wash. Yes, this month we're taking a look at the movie follow-up to the TV show that is consistently at the top of everyone's list of ones that shouldn't have been cancelled. We're taking Firefly to the big screen as we look at 2005 Serenity. So strap in, grab your dinosaur toys, and come with us as we take flight with Mal and crew for the next hour and change. I'm DK, your host once more on this month's flight into Reaver territory. And this month, I've got a solid, dependable crew with me, so let's get this Gorham show on the road. First up, he's the host of Cinema Classics, as well as the co-host on Silver Screen Regular Flavor, who was last on the show, ironically, when we looked at another space fantasy for last season's Star Wars special. This time around, we're right in his backyard, so much that he requested this one himself. It's Mr. Mike Wilson.
Hello there. Hey, there could be no better metaphor for this podcast than if I quote the start of the movie and just say, "We crashing again?"
Bit of turbulence and then we're going to explode.
Exactly. But no, I'm. Before I go any further, I do have to say this episode is brought to you by Fruity OG Bars. Fruity OG Bars. Make a man out of a mouse. Fruity OG Bars. Make you bust out of your blouse. Eat them all the time. They will blow your mind. Fruity OG Bars.
Nice one. And how are things with you, you strange little man?
I'm fine. I'm just, you know, happily being a leaf on the wind, waiting on the inevitable harpoon through the heart. But, you know, I will say, yes, as if you couldn't tell, this film is something of an obsession of mine. I did request DK to do it, and you should probably be aware that asking me to talk about this movie is basically akin to what happened to the Nazis that opened the Ark of the Covenant. So prepare to get your face melted. That's all I'm saying with that.
What have you been up to recently, fella? You been watching anything decent?
Same as always, really. I mean, I've been watching the odd little thing on TV, but nothing huge. Catching a few movies, but you can always check on Letterboxd to see what I've been watching.
Well, at least you're coming back to this one, so what you've got here. So next up, joining Mike and I today, we've got another Cult Classics regular who is last with us for our Season 2 Tron review. You've heard her already in the background. It's Jen.
Hello.
Again, thank you for hopping on this one. How have you been?
I've been all right. Got some interesting things going on with Southern California at the moment. Yeah, things have been good up here. Just work and play and reading books that I probably shouldn't be reading, and I'm not going to admit that I'm reading.
Fair enough. So, yeah, are you looking forward to this one?
Yes.
No. So straight to the point there. Yeah, great stuff. So we've got our guests already, and normally we ask what their favourite cult movie is, but seeing as they're old hats at this, I'm going to drop a couple of questions on the topic at hand. Did you see the series before you watched Serenity, or did you go back?
I was obsessed with Firefly long before Serenity came out. I was a huge Whedon fan anyway. Obviously, this is pre-cancellation. Any expression of love for the art is not necessarily an expression of agreement with the artist before I go any further. But yeah, I was fully obsessed with like Buffy and Angel. I was one of those kind of annoying fans that was really peeved when Firefly was going to come around because I was like, he should devote his attention to buffing an injury. You can see there's been a drop in quality, and I don't know what this Firefly thing is. Then it came out, and I was just immediately obsessed with it. And I was like, it's brilliant. I loved everything about it. A lot of the things I'm sure I'll talk about that are present in the movie. So I had kind of seen Firefly, and suffice to say, I was already very much a fan.
Fair enough.
What about you, Jen?
I don't remember. It was a long time. So we are technically celebrating the 20th anniversary of the movie this year, aren't we?
We are, yes.
Which means that I was 18 when it came out. 18 or 19. So I don't remember which we ended up watching first, if it was the series or the movie, but I do remember we actually would have like themed tea parties around the series. It was a lot of fun. We were really into it for a long time.
To both of you, what is it about the series that appealed to you?
Well, it's Joss Whedon's writing. He is able to use very good philosophical while remaining accessible. So we had this entertaining, funny show that was also drama and adventure and excitement. But in the midst of it, there were good messages. Like, you can't just make people better. You can't just throw things at them and expect it to fix them, because that's not how humans work. You're going to end up with side effects, and you have to acknowledge your side effects or else doomed to repeat. But also, it's just the design, everything that went into costume making for various parts of it. And it was a good story. Good stories are what carry things more than anything else. Again, I believe that Firefly should not have been canceled when it was canceled. Yeah.
Cool.
That's what I like about it so much, is that it's just, it's fully entertaining, and it actually makes you think.
Mike?
Yeah, I mean, basically seconding everything that Jen already said. But on top of that, I think the mixture of genres is incredible in the way that it works. It wasn't until I realized how much DNA sci-fi and Westerns share, you know, when I learned that Gene Roddenberry pitched Star Trek as Wagon Train to the Stars, Firefly is basically the ultimate encapsulation of that idea. It's literally like something like Wagon Train or Bonanza or something in the stars, and it uses the melding of those genres just beautifully. It works really well. And on a kind of, in a reflective way of that, the world building, the way that it combines, like, this idea that in the far future, there'll be two superpowers, and it will be the US and China. So everything will just look like that. It's so clever in the way it melds that together, or the idea of just this whole, like I said, building out this world of who the Alliance are, who the Browncoats and the Independents were, the battle that was fought, the characterization of all the characters, the Western tropes, like the, you know, the preacher and the prostitute on board, who's completely different because you've got to subvert one of these expectations. So she's actually the one that's giving them respectability in class. Just the tropes.
And remember, there is a difference between Inara being a companion, being a courtesan, and what would be considered a prostitute. Courtesans, yes, and companions are actually educated and trained.
And I mean, it's one of those things as well. I mean, it also comes from, obviously, it's like the idea of a geisha is in there as well. And ideas like that aren't necessarily what we would think of as more sexual, but it is kind of, it's melded with this Western, Wild West idea of the, you know, the hooker, I guess. But yeah, not, I mean, just aside from that, all of the characters are their own kind of cool tropes, but they're also really complex. And the storyline itself, I think, is as well. It's not really, you know, good guys versus bad guys in the clearest way. There are shades of gray there. Everything's a little bit more complex, but all the characters are at the very least interesting and compelling. It's Whedon, so there's always characters that are the heart of the show. You should watch out, because they are almost certainly going to be killed. the ones that are the purest and the sweetest, and you absolutely latch onto, and then immediately regret it, because Whedon knows how to just go,
hey, and kill them. At least they waited till the very end of the movie.
But I mean, I would be worried for Kaylee if the show had carried on, to be perfectly honest, because I think, knowing full well that she is the kind of the beating heart of the ship and the kind of everything that goes on there, I was like, yeah. But yeah, I mean, killing Wash and Buck, for that matter, was pretty harsh. But so yeah, I mean, just like I said, all of the ideas, the concepts of everything that was set up in the show, and yeah, the melding of these tropes and the cleverness of the writing, the way that.
Have you ever had a moment where you think, man, someone should really do something about this? Then you realize maybe that someone is you. Well, with the help of GoFundMe, you can change someone's life. You could start a GoFundMe to help a friend pay for school, fund that new community space, or help a local kid finally get to that national competition. I've seen this myself. Last year, a friend of mine launched a GoFundMe to help with medical bills after an unexpected surgery. It was incredible how fast the support rolled in. People want to help. They just need a way to do it. And GoFundMe makes it easy. So, do you have a dream, a person, or a cause in your life that could use some support? Don't wait for someone else to bring change. You can be the one who makes a difference. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform, trusted by over 200 million people. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com.
As Jen said, Whedon can write dialogue. Whatever else the man might be, he's a really skilled writer when it comes to relatability, but also a particular patois, a way of talking that you can latch onto.
It leads me to our next one. I mean, you know, certain accusations have come out regarding his behavior. Yeah. It's cast a shadow over him personally for many. Does that sour the experience for you? Are you in this case able to separate the art from the artist?
It sours it a bit for me. I mean, obviously I'm female, so it took a while to realize that he wrote these really kick-ass women. Zoe is a total badass. River is unparalleled in fighting. But here's the thing. River is like mentally like a child. And even Zoe is second in command. And you even have in Buffy and Dollhouse and all these other shows where these women are powerhouses. But one way or another, they're saved by a man. Okay. So it's kind of like you start realizing these little dips and these little holes. And it's like, oh, so his personality was there the whole time, but it was hidden. And now we're seeing it. And so it does kind of take away from it a little bit.
Yeah. What about you, Mike?
Yeah, it's a tricky one. As more and more kind of information was coming out, it sounds stupid, but I felt incredibly disappointed in Whedon because he was a hero of mine. It's safe to say for the longest time, he was one of the people that I was like, if you see that name on something, I'm going to absolutely love this. I think the writing's brilliant. I think he is, like I said, he's a lot of things, but I also think he is a genius when it comes to doing these things. And that's not a word I'd throw around lightly. I think that there's a level there of that. So yeah, I mean, when it came out, I was incredibly disappointed in him and felt like let down as a fan. If that doesn't sound I mean, ridiculous, obviously there are people that were a lot more hurt than me out of all of this. But on a fan level, I just found myself thinking how incredibly disappointed I was and how, like, I don't know if I necessarily see what Jen sees within the work, but perhaps that's me being blinkered. I kind of still appreciate the actual work itself, the TV shows and the movies, for what they are and on the kind of level where, thankfully, because of the nature of being kind of behind the scenes, I don't have to see or think too much about Whedon. It's kind of, it's there, and that name is kind of comes up, like I said, when you're looking at behind the scenes stuff and everything, but I guess I'm able to disassociate a little bit because, I don't know, we didn't know this at the time, any of these things about him, and I probably would find it harder in situations like Buffy and Angel because I know about what went on behind the scenes specifically of those shows. So knowing what happened to those actresses and the way they were treated is going to make it very difficult to watch that without feeling awkward. But
yeah,
the weird thing is, I mean, I've spoken to and met a few of the people who are, you know, who are from Whedon shows. I've met Charisma Carpenter, James Masters, Juliet Landau, and they've all said, like, if the work means something to you, then, you know, it means something. Everybody worked on it, and they did it for the fans and to make the fans kind of proud. And I've even seen Sarah Michelle Gellar kind of post, you know, don't want anything to do with that man, but we'll always be proud of Buffy Summers, and that she'll always be there for people if it meant something. So I think I kind of always try to latch onto that and think, well, the work means something to me, and I'm not latching onto something unpleasant. It means something to me on more deep levels than that. And I think that feeds into something I should have said earlier with regards to Firefly, was that it was one of those things that when you're a lost, lonely person and you find this idea of the found family just drifting through, trying their best, getting by, getting through the black, as they say, that's quite relatable within itself as well. So I kind of still need these characters and these stories without, you know, wanting to seem like that's me endorsing any of what went on.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that everybody here pretty much laments its cancellation. Do you wish they brought it back in TV in some context? I know there's plenty of time media, but do you think its time has kind of passed?
I think its time has passed now. I would have liked to see something from it, but I think if you were to bring it back now, it just wouldn't be the same. And I think Well, for starters, you wouldn't be able to have Whedon involved, and that's fair enough. I don't think he should work again, you know. But I also think if you're going to redo these things, it's a fool's errand to try and do them without him, because it was such a distinctive voice, for better or worse.
Yeah, I'm going to put you both on the spot here. I know we're not in the habit of looking at TV shows other than on the Who Trek channel, and if you haven't checked that out, just go and do it. Yeah, just for fun, if you had to give that lone season a score out of 5, what would it be?
4.5, maybe? Because there are, of course, always little things that could have been done better. Yeah, about 4.5.
I think I know what Mike's going to say, but go on, Mike.
I would go similar, but I would say like 4.75.
Are you just being awkward now? Just be...
No, I think it's...
as you think.
I want to go, like, it is that good, but I can't really say, like, it's perfect because, like I said, the behind-the-scenes stuff kind of taints it a little bit anyway. And even though there's only 14 episodes, as I think, on them, there's at least one that's like, yeah, this is boring, you can skip it.
Oh, cool. So, obviously, today we're going to be looking at the 2005 movie, which continues on from the show. As you've mentioned before, Mike, it's not 100% necessary. A space western film written, directed by Joss Whedon. It was his featured directorial debut, and it stars the same cast as the TV show, Nathan Fillion, Alan Tudyk, Adam Baldwin, Summer Glau, and Morena Baccarin, along with Chiwetel Ejiofor. It takes place after the events of the final episode, set in 2517, and is set primarily aboard the eponymous Serenity, a Firefly-class spaceship. Principal photography for Serenity was originally estimated to require 80 days, lasting a typical 12 to 14 hours each, with a budget of over $100 million. Unwilling to approve of such a large budget, Universal Studios wished to shoot abroad to minimize production costs. However, Whedon, reluctant to uproot his family apparently, insisted that filming take place locally and maintained that it was possible for a local production to cost fewer days and less than half the expected budget. So on March the 2nd, 2004, the movie was greenlit for production with a budget of under $40 million. At the project's completion, the film spent $39 million, which obviously is considered low for a science fiction action film featuring special effects. They expected to save money by reusing the Serenity ship interior from the TV series, but that set was not available. So instead, the ship was rebuilt using DVD images of the television series as a guide.
I have conflicting information about that.
Oh, do you know? go on.
I kind of have to assume that since the book is written, as I said, by Joss Whedon, I've got this book, The Visual Companion, that I've been going off. He says that he did keep the sets in storage from Firefly, and that is part of the reason why they were able to get costs down a little bit. But they did have to extend the sets because they weren't, you know, they weren't 360 degrees. It was very much, you know, three walls and then wherever you put the camera. So it is the same sets as the TV show, but they did have to add to them. Apparently, that's what Joss says anyway. So.
Yeah, it was filmed over a period of 50 10-hour days, beginning June 3rd, 2004, and ending September 17th, 2004. Primarily shot on Universal Studio sound stages with locations throughout LA. The sequence where the crew is pursued by Reavers after the bank robbery was filmed along the Templin Highway north of Santa Clarita. The shoot typically would have lasted 30 days, but the production completed filming the sequence in just 5. It had its world premiere at the Edinburgh International Film Festival on August 22nd, 2005, with that premiere selling out. So the festival arranged for 2 more screenings on August the 24th, which sold out in 24 hours. It was then theatrically released in North America on September 30th, 2005 by Universal Pictures to generally positive reviews and several accolades, including the Hugo Award for Best Dramatic Presentation, Prometheus Special Award, and the Nebula Award for Best Script. Despite this, it performed poorly at the box office, taking in only $10.1 million on its first weekend, and when it closed on November 17th, 2005, had a domestic box office gross of just $25.5 million.
Have you ever had a moment where you think, man, someone should really do something about this? Then you realize, maybe that someone is you. Well, with the help of GoFundMe, you can change someone's life. You could start a GoFundMe to help a friend pay for school, fund that new community space, or help a local kid finally get to that national competition. I've seen this myself. Last year, a friend of mine launched a GoFundMe to help with medical bills after an unexpected surgery. It was incredible how fast the support rolled in. People want to help. They just need a way to do it. And GoFundMe makes it easy. So, do you have a dream, a person, or a cause in your life that could use some support? Don't wait for someone else to bring change. You can be the one who makes a difference. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform, trusted by over 200 million people. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com.
International box office results were mixed, with strong openings in the UK, Portugal, and Russia, but poor results in Spain, Australia, France, and Italy. United International Pictures cancelled the film's theatrical release in at least seven countries, planning to release it directly to DVD instead. The box office income outside the US was $14.9 million, with a worldwide total of just $40.4 million. Despite this, the film, like the show that preceded it, has garnered a cult following, which, thanks to charity screenings and new viewers discovering the show, continues to grow. As usual, today's movie can be found on both physical and digital formats, depending on your location. Now, because I avoided watching the show for so long, the movie kind of sort of came and went. So while I did see the trailer in cinemas, and it did make me want to watch it, I never caught it while it was in the theatres. I do remember the posters and everything in the cinema of the entertainment centre my girlfriend and I used to visit at the time. I do remember my dad saying it would be his kind of thing that he'd like to see, but I didn't take the plunge. It was only years later when I finally saw it, and I think at that point it was on TV. I'd finally got my act together and seen the show. So I was kind of invested by then. But yeah, it wasn't on my radar at first because I was purposely avoiding the TV show. How about you guys? When and where did you see this one for the first time? And have you got any memories associated with it?
I don't remember exactly when I first watched any of it. I'm pretty sure I caught an episode or two on CW, or used to be WB at the time, before we ever really got into it. But like, it was so inconsistent on when it was on air, I kept missing it. So I didn't get to watch any more of it. And I didn't really know what it was until later on we watched the series. I'm like, oh, hey, yeah, I recognize this. But my greatest memories with it are just hanging out with my sister and friends, just talking about it and having our little get-togethers, the kind of little community that was built from it. I mean, we already kind of had our group from just regular other interests, but that part of it was always a lot of fun.
Mike?
I have very specific memories because I was very lucky to be able to see a preview screening before it was officially released or had its kind of premiere or anything. I wasn't the only one. There were lots of us that did it that kind of because of the nature of what it is. It was going around sort of trying to build word of mouth, which obviously didn't really work, around fan circles and things. So yeah, I saw it several weeks before official release at my local cinema. And on a personal level, it is probably the time that I've felt most connected as a fan to something, just because there was a bunch of like-minded people there. It was the first time, you know, in my sheltered little existence that I went in to see a screening of a movie and people were unashamedly wearing like Blue Sun t-shirts or Jane's cunning hat or various bits of cosplay and stuff. And I kind of looked around and was like, these people all love the same thing as me and get it. And yeah, it just kind of hit me on a personal level. And I just kind of remember thinking, wow, that fan group includes me. I'm one of these people. We all connect with this same thing. And it just felt a little bit special.
Nice. It is something I ask regularly, but is it something that you rewatch with any great regularity?
Not as much as I'd like to.
Fair enough. And have your impressions changed since your initial viewing?
I think for me, some of the whimsy is gone. Like it's been so long since I've watched it because it's not something that's, you know, free streaming on any service. So I had to actually borrow the DVD from my sister to watch it again. Unfortunately, I have very socially active people in my life that make things not as much fun anymore. Watching this or Firefly or any of the other Joss Whedon stuff just kind of is killed now. You know, my friends that work in the industry, that's like, I would hate to see that happen to them.
That's fair enough. What about you, Mike?
Only in the sense that I think as I get older, I see kind of more layers to the story and more of the kind of complexity and the shades of gray that are present in it. Yeah, other than that, it's just constant admiration for the performances. And obviously I love the Firefly cast coming back to do the movie. And there's so many things I can praise that I just still, I'm in awe of, even despite, like you said, the problems off screen that kind of taint this a little bit.
I mean, the good lines are still really good lines. That doesn't change. The good acting does not change. The good sets does not change.
Absolutely. And I should say I've got a couple of kind of fun behind-the-scenes stories from the aforementioned book that are about the actors and kind of shows, I think, how much... It shows how much the actors kind of bring to the roles, and it's that it's not all Whedon, even as the writer. And these actors, sorry, really got their characters and brought an awful lot to
that. I love the story for Alan Tudyk's audition. That is just... that is fantastic. Went in for his audition... He's sitting at the console and there's the dinosaurs are laid out there and he just starts playing with the dinosaurs.
And oh yeah, that's what became the whole like a curse your son with inevitable betrayal.
Yeah, exactly. They actually ended up using it in the show. And I'm just like, that's just awesome. So he like looked at me, he's like, you just embody this character.
Yeah. In terms of where Firefly came from, I did get a quote from Joss Whedon, which I thought was interesting, where he says that science fiction is absolutely an obsession. And what happened was I read Michael Schara's Civil War book, The Killer Angels, and found myself not so much thinking about Western genre as about the experience of immigrants and pioneers moving west, the dangers and the desperation of the kind of person who'd go with their family and babies into unknown territory where nobody wanted them, with nothing but what they could carry either on their backs or in their wagons. I thought putting it in a setting of science fiction would service everything that I wanted. One, the glory and the glamour and the excitement of seeing other worlds and, quite frankly, spaceships. And two, really getting into the lives of everyday people, when the phrase everyday people actually meant something very different, when it meant the kind of strength and resilience and toughness and sometimes moral ambiguity that none of us is faced with nowadays. The basic tenet was that it was analogous to the post-US Civil War Reconstruction era. Mal had fought for the South, not for slavery, I cannot stress that enough, but for the losing side. The next book that I read after The Killer Angels was about Jewish partisan fighters who'd fought in the Warsaw Uprising during World War II and some of the things they tried to pull off after the war. And that's when I realized there was no piece of history that was not useful to the story that I was going to tell, which I think is a pretty comprehensive backstory of where this came from.
Yeah. What do you think to the writing with regards to this one?
Good, classic, philosophical. And I love that he got into the whole thing of belief isn't just about believing in some sort of religious faith, believing in people, believing in what you're doing is just as powerful. Like she said, like Inara goes, he's a believer. And it's like, do you understand the strength that is behind that? Because when you are somebody that believes without a doubt in what you are doing, you get a confidence, you get a power in you that is unstoppable.
Yeah. And I think that's kind of a perfect summation of Mal's character, is that he is a man of very strong faith, just not in religion necessarily. It's other things, you know.
I will say, with regards to the writing, with regards to the plotting, and it's just a personal view, it does feel a bit like they're trying their best to wrap everything up while they can.
The way I always looked on it at the time, and maybe this is, again, my kind of biased experience, was that this is basically what would have happened if Firefly had carried on and this was like the second season finale. This was like epic two-part ending of season two. This one would have been what you would have got.
Yeah, but without that extended format that you get in a TV series, like I say, it feels kind of truncated to me. And I can see why, because I'm just grateful that we got some kind of ending to the story as it is. I've had too much experience with shows getting cancelled and wrap-up TV and movies, so I can see this is where they may be headed, had the series continued. They had an awful lot to kind of fit in. It doesn't feel rushed, I'll say that. It just feels truncated. And I think it's more to do with the fact that I would just love to have seen more of the show.
Yeah, I see what you mean. With regards to the big debts, nowhere can I find any information about why he decided to kill off Shepherd Book, other than I think the movie itself does a good enough job explaining that. It's to kind of show that the operative is a bastard, basically. You know, it's like, okay, it hits you hard enough that you realize that these are people that the Serenity crew knew and there were kids among them and families and stuff. But I think you kind of needed that personal connection to somebody that we knew as the audience. So I think the reason it's never really been explained is that that's self-explanatory. As for Wash, I mean, besides the obvious thing that, like I said, Whedon always kills off the one that's going to hurt you the most in, like, Buffy, Angel, whatever else, he does the same thing. He said in an interview in again, that book that I've read, he says that he's watched a lot of movies and no movie gets away with a siege where nobody dies, with the one exception of Zulu, which he, again, he says is a movie that can get away with a lot, including Michael Caine's pretty blue eyeshadow, but it's the only film that gets away with the, you know, a siege where everyone survives. Otherwise, it just doesn't feel believable, and there's just no stakes to anything. In that, like, end battle when everything's going on, he had to kill somebody off.
So, with regards to the plot, I mean, how did you feel this held up? I mean, you've said that this would have been the way it went had the series continued.
Yeah, it's definitely an easy way to see the build-up of the series. I mean, you really find out about the mystery of what happened to River. You see something about what happens with all of them. Just, this is what we have been doing and where it has led us. It actually fits and makes sense to the series.
I would echo that. I think the film, actually, we've kind of touched on it, but I think the film does a fantastic job of giving all the information that you need to enjoy the film itself without having seen the TV series. So it's actually kind of genius and brilliant the way that it gives you the exposition that you need without feeling like, if you are a fan, like it's retreading common ground, because it's showing you things we haven't seen that we knew about obliquely, like the rescue of River by Simon, or an explanation of what this kind of universe is, the Earth that was, that had led to this and everything. And I think, yeah, it's doing a Cliff Notes version of the world building, but it really works. And I think as you watch it now, kind of with that in mind, it's amazing how little things are there to kind of set things up or to kind of bring things into motion that are, again, really clever. Like it mentions the Reavers straight away in that like flashback of Rivers when she's a child. And we should know from then that they're going to be important. Or, you know, it shows Kaylee pining for Simon very early on in a little moment so that you immediately get the interpersonal dynamics there. The things like, as I was reading about the making and the writing of the film, it was said that it was a very specific decision to have the movie start with Book and Inara off the ship. In the case of Book, because they were going to go to somebody for refuge. And as I said, it only made sense that it be somebody the audience know, as opposed to just, here's a new character. So that made sense that in that level. And apparently when it comes to Inara, they all just agreed it wouldn't make sense for her to be on the ship because the series had ended, even with its cancellation, with her saying she was going to leave. So it would have been weird if she was still there. But I think, again, it gives you everything because you can kind of have them reuniting and have that relationship referenced and referred to in that way. And the shorthand of it is just beautifully there, whether it's the clever stuff about like, oh, it's clearly a trap, you heard us, did we fight? No, and it's a trap. Yeah. It's kind of, or, you know, oh, you can't make me angry, man, please spend an hour with him, you know. It's I'd like to share, if I may, one of my first stories about the cast understanding their characters, and it's about Malin and Nara's relationship and a subtle moment that happens in the film which I just absolutely love when I read about this, which is that there was a scene written that was supposed to be that Inara had left a crate of her belongings, and it was because they needed a way for her to suddenly have like a crate full of specific weapons when shit goes down. And so that's all it was there for. It was perfunctory. It was to serve the plot. And when the cast read the script, apparently completely separately, that obviously there was a line where Mal had kind of said, oh, you left some stuff behind, don't worry, I didn't look through it, blah, blah, blah. And apparently Nathan Fillion went up to Joss Whedon or whoever it was and said, you do realize that I've looked through every inch of that crate, yeah? No, I kind of wrote that you were honourable, and he was like, bullshit, I'm in love with this woman. I've looked through every inch of that. And then completely separately, Marina Baccarin approached him, and I love this part. Marina Baccarin approached him and said, you do realise I left that crate on purpose, right? It's got all of my nicest smelling, most delicate, most alluring things. I knew he was going to look through it. And I was like, that is brilliant. That is just absolute genius.
Well, they knew those characters. Oh, they
yeah.
were
absolutely yeah.
When people get recast, it's just like you realize how very detrimental that can be, because it doesn't just hurt the performance. Mm-hmm. It hurts how the character is portrayed, even in its writing, because there are things that are ad-libbed. There are inflections in the voice. You can't just mimic that. You can't just throw somebody in and have them. I mean, that's what actors are supposed to do.
Yeah.
In certain points, like in this, I can't imagine anyone else playing these characters. They are these characters.
Yeah. And they are. I mean, obviously that goes to show how much they took it seriously, and it wasn't just a job for them. They, you know, they lived and embodied these characters. And at the end of the day, there's no substitute for chemistry. And I think Nathan and Marina, they got chemistry. So, yeah.
Absolutely.
I don't honestly think there's one bad performance in this.
Yeah, I would agree, actually, yeah.
Oh my gosh, Summer Glaw. Her facial expressions. I love the very first beginning of it, she looks at Zoe and she points to the guy, and Zoe's like, "Really?" And she goes, "Yeah." And it's just like little things like that. And it's just, she is this almost this lithe spirit in the entire thing, a child. But then you have these moments of lucidity where it's like, no, you see that there is an immense being inside her that just can understand so much more than you could ever imagine. I mean, that would make anybody a little biggledy, as they've said. It's really cool just seeing that, especially now that I've watched it since working with children with autism. It kind of clicks in a very different way for me now. She was a dancer before she did this, right?
She was. That's how she got discovered. It was because they were making the Angel episode, Waiting in the Wings, and they cast her as a ballet dancer, because they were, that's part of that episode, is they're going to the ballet. So, yeah. You can tell. I mean, the physicality of her is just incredible. I mean, that whole stunt, which is completely her, by the way, where she's like on the ceiling, spread eagle.
Oh my gosh, that is just crazy. Up, twice.
Just holding onto the little fire extinguishery thing, and you just watch that and you're like, there's CGI or something in there. Nope, that's just her. She's just that flexible, and you know.
So would you say that Summer's your MVP for this one, Jen?
Yeah, absolutely.
I've got to go with, and it's not a regular member of the cast, I've got to go with Chiwetel Ejiofor. I think he plays the character just so well. I think he's just phenomenal in this. The amount he's been wasted in films since. So, yeah, what about you, Mike?
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I think it was Chiwetel Ejiofor, for me, who played the operative, who apparently, by the way, trained extensively in martial arts for his fight scenes. He even choreographed some movements with the stunt coordinator, and he says he reportedly loved the philosophical undertones of the character, saying it was such a compelling angle to explore. For me, the operative is a fascinating character because his sense of morality is so twisted, but sincere. Like, he genuinely believes in the greater good, even though his actions are brutal. Like, that conflict within him, the idea of sacrificing everything for a better future that he won't get to experience, I think adds so much depth to that character. It's heartbreaking, but it's chilling at the same time. And it's also interesting that how that contrasts with Mal and the crew. They fight for freedom and individuality despite the consequences. And the operative's worldview is more about control for the greater good. But Mal is the opposite. It's like about chaos and independence. And that clash of ideologies, I think, is definitely one of the film's standout themes. I think as well, if you're looking to the, like I said, the Western kind of archetypes that Whedon wants to play with in Firefly and Serenity, I think the operative is very firmly in the camp of like Ethan from The Searchers, the John Wayne character, where it's like he wants to rescue people and he wants to, you know, build this new world and this pioneering era, but he'll never get to be a part of it. He'll always be a bit outside of it. And again, that's an interesting character to bring to that. Yeah, I mean,
and you definitely see echoes of the operative in Mordo and Doctor Strange. You see some echoes of that character in there for sure.
And I do love the mirror images. It is with Mal, and it brings up that whole moral dilemma at the start where Zoe's talking to Mal about the guy who tried to get away from the Reavers.
I love that moment, even though it's really horrible. The discussion of like he had to kill him because the Reavers had him, and she's like, well, you could have dumped the money or the payload, whatever. Like, well, look, this is one job we've had in months. We're getting increasingly difficult to find, so at this point I've got
a powerful need to eat in the next month or so.
But again, I don't think there's a bad performance in this. Everybody, and when you have people like Sarah Paulson as a kind of a cameo, essentially.
Well, or David Krumholtz, who is a great actor and essentially a cameo. But he's great. I mean, he sells you so much that when there's that funeral at the end, it's two of the, you know, main characters from the show and him. And you don't question it, even though you've known him for like, you know, 3 minutes or something.
Yeah.
Did you guys even notice when he looks at the operative and he's like, okay, I've done what you asked. Now, where's my 30 coin?
30 coin, 30 pieces of silver. Yeah. I did. I know.
30 pieces of silver. Yeah. Like the whole Judas thing.
Yeah. I mean, even minor characters. I mean, there's an actor called Michael Hitchcock, who I think went on to appear in Cabin in the Woods, who's in that opening sequence. He's the guy that the operative basically, you know, makes fall on his own sword. Yeah. And he's such a good actor. And he's there for, again, like a cameo. And you're just like, this is just, it's perfect building out of this world with great performances. And I was trying to look for a bad performance, and I think because I don't like the actor as a person, for a little while I was like, I don't think Adam Baldwin's doing anything that spectacular as this Jane character, and blah, blah, blah. But then even then, you're kind of, there's little moments, and then I found myself kind of begrudgingly accepting even how good he is, because in that last fight, there's that just brilliant moment where Zoe's just so resigned. Everything's happened. And she's like, you really think any of us are getting out of here? And it's just the sort of whimpery ways, like, I might.
Yeah.
It's beautiful, man. It's just perfect.
There's that line earlier on as well where Kaylee's going, you know, I haven't had anything twixt my nethers that hasn't been running on batteries.
You had to mention it.
I don't want to hear that.
And it's standing here a little bit.
Yeah.
There's 9 main characters in Firefly, and they're all kind of having to be serviced, pardon the pun, in the film. And they all have great interpersonal dynamics, and they all get at least that one little moment in the film. And I'd love that. We've pointed to so many of them already, but even like River's more lucid moments when she's telling Simon how she knows everything he's done for her, and then it's her turn.
That still kind of is a heart in throat moment where she jumps through that hole, and the next thing you see is like the Reavers dragging her. Every time I just say, oh my God. So it's just a punch the air moment when the doors open and she's just stood there with blood dripping from the axe and stuff.
It is, but it's just, I also love how beautifully it's like, you have that cheer, like, oh wow, she's done it. She's kind of fully become Buffy or whatever and killed all of these Reavers. But it doesn't even give you the second to cheer, because then the door blows and the Alliance burst in and you're like, oh, what the F?
Yeah.
Yeah, but the framing of that scene is just gorgeous. Brilliant.
It is. It's fantastic. And again, it's pretty much all Summer Glau, all of those moves, because she is a dancer. All of the kind of, you know, movement of her, fluidity of her body and the attacks and everything, the martial arts, all come from her. And I think it shows. I think it makes a huge difference when you're not relying on a stunt double or CGI or whatever, and you've just got that level of something.
You know, I always thought you want to have somebody who is an amazing martial artist, put them martial arts and dance. Completely. You're going to get the fluidity. You're going to get the grace. You're going to get the physical awareness.
I couldn't agree more. And you can see why Summer Glau ended up getting cast as a Terminator not long after.
Anything with regards to the direction on this that you want to bring up?
Yeah, I think it's great how he was able to have it be local, like using the high school for Miranda and everything. Direction-wise, I never thought that he has ever shown poor work, despite how he has behaved otherwise. There's a reason why he has done as successfully as he has and gotten the jobs that he has.
I think he knows how to frame things well, and I think he knows how to do both action and keep it light. And I think the moments of humor, they fit in well. They don't, none of them kind of feel forced. And same with the action scenes. There's nothing that you look at and think, oof, that's not good. Just little moments like when Mal's fumbling to get his weapon out of the locker in the bar, and he does it and you know, raises it to target River, only for River to be targeting him with another gun.
Yeah.
Yeah. In terms of the actual direction, Whedon has said that movies in general should feel like the people in them do. The way A Taxi Driver puts you so firmly in Travis Bickle's mind. This movie is about an unhewn bunch, so their frame is casual, unsteady, and just a little bit off. Because the story is being told by the girl in their midst with the mind that's not quite right, it should feel loose, unschooled, and it almost completely hides the fact that it's a fairy tale. It's nice to see that everything was thought through. You know, it wasn't just point and shoot. But in terms of the direction, my favorite moment in the movie is actually early on. It's the long shot that introduces Serenity and the crew. Because right after we've had that like opening flashback, we hear David Newman's beautiful theme, which I just absolutely adore. It made me go and buy the soundtrack. And it's kind of like, it's a mixture of Western cowboy tones and a little bit of Eastern mysticism. We see the ship, the name, see that it's in trouble landing, and then track it through, hitting orbit, and then we track through the ship, meeting every character as they react to the near crash, and it shows off each character and their quirks and personality just perfectly. Captures the heart of the film and of like Firefly, I think, in a nutshell, which you need. The seamless flow of the shot, the way it's like a love letter to the crew and so the fans, and a statement about what the movie is. It's intimate, character driven, but it's got big stakes and a sense of fun. And Serenity is kind of part of the family as well, so it does kind of feel like you're coming home if you're a fan of these things, I think. I noticed that at the very towards the end, when Miles kind of realized the message and he has the truth that he wants to be spelled out, he is specifically washed out in the kind of crew. I suppose it's the galley that they're standing in. He's washed out in like almost angelic light. You almost can't see him. And I have to feel like that was a deliberate plan to say something about where we are in this position. You know, everybody in that room wants to do the right thing, including Jane, because at that point he's kind of still feeling the loss of Shepherd Book. the last act of the film are kind of stereotypical, but somehow rise above it. Because I've seen so many films that end with, like, the two main characters, hero and villain, sorry, having, like, a face-off while there's a siege happening elsewhere. And I'm thinking of, like, the Star Wars movies, the Star Trek movies and stuff, they all do it. And yet it feels somehow fresh when you're watching it on this one.
It does have elements of the last few next-gen films.
Yeah,
with Picard going and, you know, fighting next to a big weapon or a big generator or something. This feels much more visceral.
Yeah, I love that the film just goes to pains to show throughout, though, that, like, as much as we kind of want Mal to be an honourable man, he ain't afraid to fight dirty. So he's, like, he's already had that brilliant moment. Again, I just love, because it sums up the character, where the operative's like, I want to discuss this like civilized men. I'm unarmed. And he just, oh, good, and shoots him. And he's like, well, of course I'm wearing body armor. You know, I'm not an idiot. But I'm like, that sums up Mal perfectly. He's like, yeah, I don't give a crap about honor. I just want to win this, you know?
But I do like the fact
it's
that...
It's about survival first.
Yeah, exhaust, yeah.
I do like the fact that he doesn't... When he's got the upper hand, he doesn't kill him.
He ties him up.
Yeah, I'm going to show you all without sin.
This time around watching it, I kind of noticed that... Again, it feeds into the nature of what the operative is. So at the very end, when he says, you know, oh, I think they know I'm not their man anymore, but okay, it's a little bit convenient that he calls everyone off and fixes Serenity and whatever else, but we'll forgive it because it makes sense. You know, the secret's out now. What are you going to do? But it's just that last line, the way that Mal says, you know, if I see you again, I might be fixing to kill you myself. And the operative replies with, you won't. There's nothing left to see. A powerful enough line within itself. But when you realize that he spent the entire movie talking about, like, you know, you fail so spectacularly, you've got to kill yourself, I kind of got to think he's just about to go off screen and commit suicide.
Yeah.
You know, so, like, why would you have to kill him?
Yeah, I didn't think about that.
I've got to ask, because I saw a piece of audience feedback earlier. What did you think to the revelation regards to the Reavers?
It was smart, and it makes sense because you have those reactions even now in medications where you have exact opposite.
Again, I think it was Joss who said this, about the Reavers, said that every story needs a monster. In the stories of the Old West, it was the Apaches. He explained that he removed the racial aspect of the Apache metaphor by using the Reavers, saying that I use that example by saying that anyone who goes out into space and goes mad can become a monster. The purpose Reavers serve in the show has been compared to the Hollywood, quote-unquote, engines of the 1950s in Western movies by some outside sources, but I think it's a lot more complex than that, although I can see how you might sort of feed them into that trope.
Here's a question for you. Do you honestly think that kind of madness and savagery in the head, that kind of ferocity, that they would go become a pack animal? Or do you think that they would actually tear each other apart?
If you're looking at it on a metaphorical level, then the Reavers are very much a cult. And cults don't attack their own. You know what I mean? They go after other people and they group together.
They're almost like a zombie analog.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or, like, I mean, it's Whedon, so, like, sense. Vampires, you know?
Yeah. I will say, going back to the direction, that bit where they're trying to get through Reaver territory and they've got the garbled communications and there's people screaming and ships being torn apart, that is just chilling to me. It gives me... The communications, it gives me Event Horizon vibes.
Definitely, yeah, definitely. I mean, there's... Bits in the series that I won't quote, but bits that you can quote from the series and stuff that make the Reavers seem terrifying. And that's what I love about this is that watching the series, they were a thing. And I didn't think they were something that tied into the other plots, like the Alliance and Mal's fight against them and stuff. But the way that clearly that was always the intent, I would say, look, watching the movie and the way that's done, I think is really clever, that the way it threads everything together and makes them relevant to that plot. I absolutely love that.
Like that, the person that gave the feedback, you don't think it kind of takes away some mystery as they were just kind of
really
mysterious
don't. I almost commented
space.
I almost commented on that because I so like vehemently disagree. I think that it actually it makes the world make a lot more sense, and it's a revelation that kind of once it's there, you just kind of think absolutely, of course, it makes sense. And I think there's enough mystery in the Firefly universe that should perhaps remain a mystery, or that we'd love to know more about. And I don't think we need the Reavers. I mean, we've got the Blue Sun guys, the Hands of Blue. They're one kind of, you know, sinister
Hands
villain
of
mystery.
Blue, two by two.
Exactly. We've got like Shepherd Buck's backstory, which should have remained a mystery because it's more compelling that way. And in that regard, I kind of agree with the guy's sentiment that made that comment. But I think, is it Mal or Jane that says, like, I never quite made peace with the idea that it was just people who had been to the edge of space and saw blackness and then it drove them so mad. And Jane's like, I've been to the edge of space. It just looks like more space. doesn't make you mad.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, no, it makes sense that they were something that was created, because even one episode that they have about the guy that they, like, quote unquote, rescue. No, this guy was driven mad in a specific way. It wasn't just seeing what was done. It was seeing the reactions of the people doing it. Because
yeah.
A lot of times there isn't just seeing the consequences of something. It's seeing the darkness and the malice in the person who causes it.
Yeah.
That can make you snap, because you never want to believe that that exists.
Definitely. And the Reavers, by their very existence, and again, it's touched on in the film, I think it's Jane again who says it, they don't even need to do anything, because you take one look at them and think, like, why would somebody tear up their own face like that and look like that and do that to themselves? It's kind of, it's almost like Cenobite-esque. Again, something you'd appreciate, DK. You know, it's like these people have just, they've butchered themselves. Why would you, I can't understand why you would do that, let alone then become, you know, this cannibalistic, horrible thing that does unspeakable things. And the idea that that's been created by the Alliance that wants to be all like, no, be peaceful, be great.
Well, I mean, when you are under any influence of something like that, you can tell they were starting to stop feeling anything. Mm. So cutting on themselves made them feel something. Cutting also releases endorphins so that your body can manage the shock of the injury. It's a lot of chemical things that happen in the brain when you start doing things like that to yourself. So if they do something like put something in themselves that's going to constantly cause pain, it's because they're trying to feel something because they can't feel anything anymore.
Which I suppose then feeds into the the more horrible side of things of like, there's no morality because they're willing to do anything just to feel. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. So it becomes like that sadly includes some really awful things, you know? In a weird sort of way, I suppose they're analogous to the Borg from Star Trek, and that they're all kind of like, you're either going to become one of them or be horribly killed, and they're just an oncoming force, and they just rebuild and rebuild and rebuild, and they just scavenge from other people. They have no culture of their own, but they will somehow keep moving and keep coming at you, and yeah, it's horrible.
Cockroaches?
Yeah, exactly, cockroaches. Yeah. I don't know if you've seen any of the Reavers' kind of makeup effects or anything.
Oh my gosh.
They specifically kept a lot of the more horrific Reavers in the background, and they're just kind of fleetingly seen. And they had what they call like hero Reavers, which are more palatable, which are the ones that you actually see up close.
Yeah.
And if you see the behind the scenes, you know, continuity shots or makeup tests and stuff of them, my word, they're freaking horrific. Like, they are straight from a horror movie. And the makeup effects, whoever it was, I didn't look it up, I'm sorry, but whoever it was that did those effects has done a stunning job of making them look just like, you don't even want to look at them for a second, you know?
So, yeah, with regards to Prussian design, how do you feel it holds up?
Watching it last night, again, for the first time in years, it wasn't dated. It didn't feel like an old movie. Yeah, the CG is not quite as sharp or as detailed, maybe, as what we see now, but it still holds up. It still has a place in future watching for other people and people discovering it for the first time and not being thrown off because, oh, this was so clearly made in the 2000s. Like, no, it actually holds up really well.
Yeah, it doesn't have that vibe to me.
Me neither. I think the VFX and the CGI stuff, I think, is flawless. But that's because I love the world and I love these ships and stuff. So to me, it's always going to look like it looks. And it doesn't look overly computer generated or stylized, you know. It just is. But I think part of that is also the things that were established from the series, like the handheld nature. So when you're out in space, everything does look like you're kind of a documentary camera swooping to try and catch things before they shoot away or whatever. And just the simple idea that when you go to space, everything's silent, which not any other sci-fi really does, even though we know that would be exactly what it would be like.
Yes, I still think it holds up very well. I don't know if you found that out, Mike. I presume you did in your book. That Fruity Oatly Bar commercial.
Make it weirder. Make it weirder. Just a little bit more weirder.
Yeah. And it was inspired by, apparently, Mr. Sparkle.
Oh, really? I didn't know that, actually. But yeah, that's what...
Yep.
I do know that there is such a thing as a real Fruity Oatly bars in the world that you can get. And it is marketed to children. So
that makes sense.
Yeah. Speaking of which, the sound design. It was the first time I'd actually watched it in the credits, hoping that they'd kind of do a refrain on the
sing it.
The the Firefly theme. They do, but you know, it's obviously
it's like it's just ornamental. Yeah,
yeah.
It's different people. That's the thing as well. The Firefly soundtrack is by a different person. I forget who, but I went and bought both as soon as I'd seen the movie because I love both the soundtracks. But yeah,
I appreciate the moments of just silence because there's a lot of movies and series out there that will have soundtrack to everything, but then there's something going on. There is no soundtrack. It's just them talking.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of room to breathe and silence within even the music, as you say, which echoes the kind of silence and space idea. I looked it up, by the way, if anybody is interested. It's Greg Edmondson that did Firefly soundtrack, and it's David Newman that does Serenity, which is why there isn't any real kind of callbacks to some things. It's Sonny Rhodes, I think, that sings the actual Ballad of Serenity that was the show's opening credits. So good. Incredible. I don't do this a lot. I know some people do, but I don't go out and buy soundtracks after seeing a film. And when I saw Serenity, I was like, I've got to get. And I went and bought, like I said, bought both soundtracks, the movie and the TV show. And it's one that I can just have on, and it's so evocative. It's a beautiful listen, completely independently to the movie, but it also fits the tone and the visuals of the movie as well.
Yeah, I love the touches of the old Western sounds that you get in some of them. As one piano tuner has said, the piano sound that you get, the piano that's not quite tuned.
Yeah. I think the sound design for the movie was pretty good. I mean, you already brought it up, Mike, the fact that there's no sound in space. I do like that they leaned into that. We're going in now into the legacy of this thing. And apparently Universal, they wanted to do an animated prequel. But after Whedon and Brett Matthews wrote a story, Universal scuttled the project. It was rewritten into a three-issue comic book, Those Left Behind.
Which is really good, actually. I do recommend that one.
Yeah, there have been several comic follow-ups linking the series and movie. Other than the aforementioned, there was Better Days, 2008. And a one-shot hardcover, The Shepherd's Tale. I presume that's
not so good.
Wasn't that great? Yeah, along with the one-shot Serenity Downtime and The Other Half and Float Out, in which Whedon explored plot strands he'd intended to explore further in the series.
Yeah, I can give you a spoiler from one of those because one of them's written by Patton Oswalt, and it's kind of it's fine. It's all just basically reminiscences about Wash, but it's that makes it a little boring. But the big thing is that it reveals at the end of the miniseries that Zoe's pregnant with his daughter, which apparently was something that would have happened had everything gone on. Written or co-written by Patton Oswalt, so if you look that up.
Because apparently there was a six-issue, I mean, I've not read any of them myself, there was a six-issue one, Leaves on the Wind, which were released in 2014, which took place after the events of the movie, and the one was one that followed on No Power in the Verse, set about a year and a half after Leaves on the Wind. In 2018, Boom Studios announced they'd acquired the comic book and graphic novel, and I presume that's the current people that are doing these ongoing adventures.
Just to avoid it like the plague, all new Firefly with constant comic book events and stuff. It's a turd. I'm not going to lie to you.
There were also talks of the movie sequel, first mentioned around December 2005. When Universal expressed an interest in making a TV movie, it was expected that commissioning of a television sequel would be contingent on strong DVD sales. Obviously, that didn't pan out. Whedon, as early as 2006, shortly after, doubted that a sequel would be happening. Did it while debunking a rumor that he was already working in one. In an interview in 2007, he stated he believed hope for a sequel rests in the sale of the collector's edition DVD, but obviously that never panned out. No. Although, something I didn't know about, in July 2014, Firefly Online was announced, which are planned to have the cast reprise their roles. And although it was never officially cancelled, there have since been no updates.
There is a thing on Screen Rant, a Firefly cast reunion set for the 20th anniversary of Serenity. The reunion is going to be at Emerald City Comic Con in Seattle. It's going to include Nathan Fillion, Summer Glau, Jewel State, Gina Torres, Marina Bekron, and Sean Bear. Yeah.
Okay, that makes sense. So it's all the characters that are left alive, either in-universe or in the world, I suppose.
Well, except for
Jane. Jane's not there.
Well, we know why that is.
Yeah.
I have to say as well, since you're talking about legacy, just very quickly, that do look around if you're listening to this and you're a fan for any kind of screening events, because they are all done for pretty much charity, and I've had a lot of them even around where I live, which normally we don't get any kind of big things, but they'll often have something and it'll be called like Can't Stop the Signal, and it'll be like they'll rent out a cinema, or a cinema will agree to show Serenity, and you'll all go watch it, and then whatever proceeds you make are all donated to charity, so it's always for a good cause.
So. Yeah, in January 2020, Fox Entertainment president Michael Thorne said that a revival series had been considered, but decided that since The Orville was on the air, it wouldn't make sense for the network to have two space franchises at the same time. Which
because you never have two of the same thing on the air.
No, so no.
Like, we haven't got seven
how many
CSI
time series have we got? Fucking hell. Yeah, so as of now, there's been no further talk of a sequel, and it's not looking like that's going to happen.
It's never going to happen now, no.
So, other than, you know, if they do that Firefly Online with them reprising their characters through voices, I can't see it happening.
There is a series, by the way, of Firefly books that I haven't read, but I'm kind of intrigued to because they have quite good reviews. And there's already like 9 of them, and they're still ongoing. There's another one due for release this year. So, if you get a chance to check those out, maybe they're good. I don't know. I think they're all set during the series, though, which is kind of weird, but I suppose they didn't want to extend that universe any further.
As we've said, the movie, as well as the series, it's growing in cult status, but what is it about this one that stands out for you? Any particular aspect that draws you back to it?
Characterization, the story, the layers, the dimensions. And again, I'll mention, I'm sure, more things in my conclusion when it comes up.
I think for me, this one, it's the world building. That's us here today. But what about you? As is the norm, we put out a request for your thoughts on our socials to gauge your reaction. So as expected, here's Vian to go over what you said. Hey, Vian.
Thanks, DK. I was surprised to see there wasn't a ton of feedback for this one, but that could be just from my own personal experience. Firefly and Serenity were two of my ex-boyfriend's favorite things, and I couldn't stand it, but I do regularly get the jingle for Fruity Oaty Bars stuck in my head, almost as frequently as the Lifeform song from Generations, so they can both burn in hell for that. But Anita Harris says, how about the Serenity Strikes Back or Return of the Serenity sequel now? Or in a world rebooting long-past TV shows with increasing frequency, surely the magnificent beast that was Firefly could rise from the proverbial ashes someplace where content is king. You know where I mean. So, you know, Anita, probably somewhere, sometime, one of these producers is going to listen because they are rebooting absolutely everything, as you say. Kim, I'm not going to butcher your last name, said, you can't take the sky from me. And by sky, I mean this Blu-ray. Jeremy Tangwe said, such an amazing movie. Honestly, this beats any flashy sci-fi movie, hands down. That's because they weren't using excessive amounts of green screen back then. We say back then, and wasn't that long ago, but different times. Christopher Page on the Silver Screen Movie Group says, love the series, and I like the movie, mostly. I love all the characters and the people who portray them, and I love the look of everything from the series beefed up to be on the big screen. What I didn't care for is a big chunk of the story. Oh, that's a problem. I think the Reavers work best as this unexplained, unseen boogeyman, showing them and going too far as giving them a science run-amok origin story belittles them. They aren't as scary when they're turned into punk biker zombies who were victims of some government conspiracy. Unfortunately, if you drop that, you do not have a movie at all, so I guess I like it, but don't. LOL, 3 out of 5 for me. You know, I had a similar complaint about the Borg, talking Star Trek. In First Contact, I felt they kind of neutered the Borg and made them just another megalomaniac kind of force with the Borg Queen. So, yeah, I get where you would feel that way. And Skin, I actually saw the movie before knowing anything about the series, and I loved it. It's a 4 out of 5 for me. I did go on to watch the series, which was also pretty good. So I would hope if you like the movie, you like the show, too. Watching it backwards is kind of interesting. So with that, tossing it back to you, DK.
Nice one, Vian. Cheers. Thank you to everyone that helped us out by giving us their opinions. And again, if you missed out, socials are always open. So let us know what you think, or in the comments on here for that matter, just drop us a line. And as usual, links in the description. So with your opinions established, it's time to finally hear what the conclusions here in the studio are. And as always, come to our guests first. So Jen, you're up. What's your score out of 5 and your final thoughts for this one?
I would say 4 out of 5. There were some things with the costumes that I believe could have been done better. the CG could be updated a little bit. It's just a tiny bit too clean. But overall, it is a good movie. The story is sound. It settles up the things that we were questioning from the series. You get a good look into what exactly is going on with Summer Glau's character, which, by the way, I find it quite amusing that Sean Mayer often called her Summer instead of River. For me, it's not just, you know, it's a great action film. So you can get the people that love action. You've got just a touch of romance in there, but it's not overwhelming. You've got some comedy in there to keep things light. And then you've got a deeper note in there about the story, and just things are not as simple as they seem. You have to understand there's more than one meaning to something. There's more than one way things can be done, and it's not going to be crystal clear. It's not going to be a straight line. Life is not a straight line. And I've always appreciated that.
Cool. Mike?
You know, I've said it before, but there are some films that just hit you where you live. They're special, touching that place in your heart where passion and love come from. Some films speak to you, feel like they were made just for you. Not that it isn't a thrill to discover others who share your affection and make you feel things in ways you can't always define. I love Serenity, and that alone would be enough. But the film analyst in me could also talk about it for days as well, as you probably can tell. I truly believe it's a perfect, flawless piece. It does the unenviable job of serving as a love letter for fans of the franchise it belongs to, whilst also being entirely accessible on its own. The characters have depth, relatability, and are admirable, lovable, funny, or any combination of these, and the performances that bring them to life are pitch perfect. The writing is sublime, wit, action, profound without being pretentious, and themes you could spend a full course exploring. The direction is beautiful and fitting, the lighting is cinematic gold, and the effects all work brilliantly for me. The music, hauntingly stunning. I can even forgive the deaths of beloved characters because at least they make you feel something. If you didn't love them, you wouldn't care. So obviously something went right. Plus, the film cleverly rewards you instead of being entirely bleak. As devastating as the losses are, they're offset by the joy of seeing couples get together or reunite, people discovering their strengths, and ultimately truth triumph as it enters the world. Jeez, this really is a fairy tale. Then again, big dang heroes or not, it's also bloody inspiring, thought-provoking, and yes, touching. As you can probably tell, I'm passionate about this, and I probably always will be. You can't stop the signal. I give it 5 out of 5. Surprising, absolutely no one.
Yeah, there's a twist. yeah, it's. I'm going to give it 4.5. It's full of likable characters. It gives its audience a feeling of a universe fully populated with an expansive lore to match. Taking a short-lived TV series and fleshing out for the big screen is no mean feat, especially on such a reduced budget. But props where it's due, the cast and crew behind this one rose to the task admirably. There isn't one bad apple here among the cast, not one poor performance. Even if some characters feel slightly shortchanged for me, the additions serve their parts well, and it looks phenomenal even 20 years later. Like the TV series that preceded it, it's a damn fine piece of science fiction adventure. And like said TV series, it's a shame more people didn't give this a chance, because it's a really great way to spend 2 hours. If I have one minor niggle, and it is minor, it's what I referred to earlier. It's that it feels a little truncated. The cancellation of the show and the limited time of a feature that wasn't necessarily to get a sequel creates an impression of a fire sale at times for me. It may be a personal issue, but again, feels like such a wasted opportunity for such a great franchise. So yeah, that's that. So, you know, averaging them out. That's
not a hard average to work out for you, really.
It's four and a half and five. Easy one, yeah. So I get my wish this time. Not too shabby, I don't think. I think, you know, they're all fairly up in the top regions for scores. So I think it's done quite well. That's it for us, as always. Hope you've enjoyed this one. And if so, please like and subscribe. We'll be covering more cult classic and other movies soon enough. I'd just like to thank our guests for some good conversation on this one. So first of all, Jen, thank you for once again gracing us with your presence.
Anytime.
Anything you'd like to share with our listeners while you're here? You're working on anything right now?
Not particularly. I'm working on a few projects for my art, but that is a massive undertaking that I might eventually get around to moving on to the next step with, because I finished the sketches for it. But yeah, the actual paintings are going to take some time.
You'll keep us informed then, yeah?
Yeah. If you want to see some of my other art, You can go to Valinstarr at Instagram, ValinStarr.
Nice one. Mike, thank you, fella.
You're very welcome. I mean, apologies to anybody who had to listen to me ramble for quite so long. I'm not always quite this, you know.
Did it live up to your expectations?
Oh, definitely, definitely. And apologies to you, DK, and to Jen for not being able to get a word in edgewise. Like I said, I'm not normally quite so passionate as this. It just happens to be something that I love. And apologies to any audience members who thought we were reviewing the 2019 Matthew McConaughey thriller, Serenity. We're not. It's a 2005 movie.
They should know better by now.
Well, yeah, no, it's been good to have you on, man. Although you owe me now, so I am looking forward to that Close Encounters.
I'm literally paying you back in a couple of weeks when we review Arsenic and Old Lace.
Yeah, all right, I'll take it. So, yeah, our links will be in a lot on the login in the moment, as well as their usual place, the description. So that aside, have you got anything you want to draw the audience's attention to?
No, they're probably sick of hearing it, but always look either in the description for our link tree or on screen if it happens to be on screen for our various links. There's always a link tree around with our various social medias whilst they still exist and haven't been, you know, completely co-opted by the right wing. We're still around on most of them. And yeah, just mainly I think our YouTube channels or anywhere you get podcasts are the best places to find us.
Cool. So yeah, thank you to you, the audience, for joining us. Again, I hope you've enjoyed yourselves here with us today. I'll be back next month, first Tuesday, same as ever, where this time we'll be taking a step into the fifth dimension. So please do join us for that one. Until then, take care of yourself. And remember, I am a leaf on the wind. Watch how I saw.
You have been listening to the Cult Classic Show, part of the Silver Screen Podcast. Created, written, and hosted by DK. Editing by Nick. Produced by Mike Wilson. Feedback section produced by Lady Vienne. Opening credits by Ian Sanderson. Music by Timeless Journey. Follow us on social media. Links to all of our social media pages can be found on our link tree. And don't forget to like, subscribe, and share. This has been a Mad Badger production for the Media Matters Podcast Network. Copyright 2024. Thank you for joining us. We hope to see you next time. And remember, no matter where you go, there you are.